Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Theology in the Raw. I have on the show today my friend Heather Scriba. A few months ago, Heather was out here in Boise, Idaho, and we were taking part in a filming project, which I'm sure you'll hear about in due time. And in between filming sessions, I said, Heather, hey, let's go have a conversation for my podcast. And so we went downstairs and we had a conversation. Now, the audio on this is going to be a little rougher because, well, it's hard to explain, but the setup was different. I had just my iPhone and some sort of external microphone connected to my iPhone. And so the quality is better than just simply having an iPhone microphone, but it's not as good as what you're hearing right now in my nice polished Shure microphone, my audio setup here in my basement. So the audio is going to be a little rougher. Also, this conversation that I had with Heather is also on my YouTube channel. So I know most of you don't pay attention to my YouTube channel. Most people are either kind of podcast only or YouTube only. And so that's why I'm trying to release these conversations both on my YouTube channel and in the podcast. So if you want to get a visual of our conversations, you can go to my YouTube channel, just punch in Press and Sprinkle on YouTube and you'll get right to it. And the title of this is Transgender and the Gospel. If you want to support this show, you can do so through my Patreon account, patreon.com/theologyintheraw. The info is in the show notes. Also, if you want to support me through Venmo, you can do that as well. People have been asking me how they can support me. People have been asking me about if I have a Venmo account. It's super easy to kick over some cash in thankfulness for the ministry that I'm doing here. So if that's you and you'd like to support me, you can go to my Venmo account. The info is in the show notes. All right, let's get to know Heather Scriba. You guys are going to love this conversation. She's super raw, super authentic, and super gospel-centered. All right, welcome to the show, Heather Scriba. To my YouTube channel again. I'm here with my friend Heather Scriba. Heather, thanks so much for being live. Well, not live, but it's recorded on my YouTube channel. Is just called Press and Sprinkle, but Theology in a Raw is a podcast that I run as well. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah,
the show.
Yeah.
We actually never met. We've got several mutual friends, mm-hmm. and we've corresponded on email a little bit, and then you came out to be part of this filming project, and I would just love for you to tell your story, and then we can, I'm sure that's going to spark a bunch of questions, and we can kind of follow up from there. So tell us who Heather Scriba is.
Yeah. So my story, I grew up in like a Christian home, but my mom was Methodist and my dad was Catholic. And so even just between those two like faith denominations, like I got a lot of conflicting messages about like who God is, like what does faith mean? What, even just like salvation, like there's two fundamentally different views on salvation between Methodists and Catholics. And so I was just really confused about like what it meant to be a Christian. And my parents got divorced when I was in second grade, and that led to a lot of like family dynamics being really rough. Like my mom was emotionally unavailable and my dad was physically and emotionally and verbally abusive. And so, it led me to like project all of that negative relationships with my parents onto God too. So like my mom is absent, therefore God is absent. My dad's like abusive and abrasive, and therefore God is too.
And so both parents, mm-hmm. not just the father representing dad, but both mother and father shape your view of God.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, like God the Father, but then there's the comfort of the Holy Spirit, right. And that's the more mothering, nurturing role. Yeah. And so I missed out on both of those as a kid. And so my view of God was just really, really distorted. But it led me to like not want anything to do with God as a kid. Like I would go to youth group just to keep my parents happy. I would go to church on Sundays to avoid arguments later. But it was never something that I wanted anything to do with. Mm-hmm. And that continued all throughout like middle school and high school. Like I went through the motions, but I was really turned off to God. Like I didn't want anything to do with him. And I quite frankly just wanted to go to college and start over. Like I wanted to be myself and just like abandon all of this like negative baggage. Because like my dad's view of like women and femininity was really narrow. And I just could not meet his expectations of what that was supposed to be like. Like, he thought women needed to, like, have long hair, like, to wear dresses, wear makeup. And I, like, wore camouflage and, like, played with my brother's G.I. Joes. And so we just had, like, two fundamentally different perspectives and experiences. And when we would have, like, tension about it, he would, like, look at me and say, like, I always wished that I had a daddy's girl as a daughter. Mm-hmm. And what that communicated to my, like, 8-year-old heart was like, I'm not the daughter that my dad wants. Like, being around my femininity or my version of femininity brings my dad pain. Like, it's defective. It's not good enough. And I internalized that, like, as my identity, as my value. So, like, that caused me to develop a lot of social anxiety, a lot of insecurity, a ton of self-hatred. And so by the time that I got, like, turned 18 and was ready to go to school, I was ready to be out. Like, I just needed a clean start. So when I got to college, I went to University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and I was ready to, like, just really, like, turn away from any, like, traditional or conservative, like, idea from my background. And instead, like, I wanted to take a women's studies course and expose myself to other, like, just other worldviews. Cause, like, I grew up in small town northern Michigan, like, where everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
So, like, just what's out there is really limited.
Yeah.
But on my first day of classes, like, Jesus interrupted my story, as he often does. And there was a group of people from a campus ministry handing out surveys. And they were basically saying, like, hey, fill out a survey and you get a free discount card. And as a now poor college student, I thought, why not? So, like, the questions on the survey were really simple. It was like, do you want a personal relationship with God? Are you interested in a Bible study and maybe one more? And I think I checked, like, maybe or, like, sort of interested, but very noncommittal answers. But that was enough for them to start reaching out to me. And after, like, 6 weeks of making excuses for why I couldn't go to, like, their Bible study and, like, campus gatherings, I finally, like, I just didn't have any more excuses. So I thought, okay, I'll go once and then that'll get them off my back. Like, they'll stop calling me every week. But at the, like, all campus gathering that I went to, the message was called The Music of the Gospel. And the premise of it was, if we're dancing without music, it's exhausting. Like, there's no joy in it. It's, like, devoid of all, like, things that are life-giving. But if you hear the music of the gospel, like, things that we normally call religious actually become life-giving and enjoyable. And it's something that you want to invite other people into. And it's something that, like builds your faith and builds your joy and increases your quality of life instead of, like, something that is just a meaningless act. Mm-hmm. And I realized that these people had an experience of God that I had never had before. And whatever the different thing was that they had, I wanted that version of God, not the version that I knew growing up. Mm-hmm. So that propelled me to give my life to Jesus and realize that, like, there is kindness there. There is kindness in the heart of God. And, like, I want to experience that, like, personal, like, relationship with God that makes me want to dance to the music of the gospel.
Wow.
And after I, like, became a Christian and started pursuing God and pursuing faith, like, I started asking a lot of those apologetic questions that you ask, like, why do good things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? Questions about, like, science and faith and how can those things coexist? Like, are dinosaurs real? How old is the earth? Just those big
all questions. The fun ones.
Yeah, you know, and, like, the woman who was discipling me, like, just was so patient. It was really sweet of her. She, like, brought out Josh McDowell's, like, evidence that demands a verdict, and we went through it together.
Nice.
But then I was also asking these heart-level questions of, like, why does God let suffering happen to people? Like, why did my, like, upbringing, why did he let that be so hard? Like, why did I feel so much self-hatred and anxiety and insecurity? Like, these questions that are more personal and that I had used my pain to distance myself from God. But now that I was in a relationship and, like, following after him, like, we began peeling back those layers. And then one of the areas, like, as I was processing through all these things, one of the areas that I got really stuck was about, like, LGBT issues in the Bible. in my mind, I was thinking, like, how could a loving God say that two people loving each other is bad? Like, that just felt really arbitrary. Like, if he's God, like, he could have changed it. He could still change his mind, maybe. Like, I just couldn't grasp, like, what was so bad about it or what was wrong about it. And through, like, being so stuck on it, like, I was stuck on it for months, probably years even. I realized, like, I had personal stake in this game. I was so stuck on this because it shed light on the fact that, like, I am holding out on the fact that, like, I really hope I can date a woman someday. And being in a more, like, progressive setting and, like at a university, like, I started to, like, get vocabulary to talk about, like, oh, like, I'm attracted to women. Like, the church calls that same-sex attraction. This university just, like, calls it, like, being gay or being lesbian or whatever, like, the terminology is. Like, there's more flexibility there. And it gave me vocab to talk about it that the church hadn't equipped me with. And, like, having language is really empowering. Yeah. And so I finally felt like, oh, there's a word for this. So therefore, like, someone else had to have struggled with this before. And so as I began opening up to, like, my Christian community about it, like, they were very much, like, okay with me wrestling with it, like, on a head level. Like, you can wrestle with big picture theology of, like, what does God say about LGBT stuff in the Bible. But the second it becomes personal and you think about, like, can I, Heather, date a woman? They shut that down immediately. And they're like, we're not comfortable with this. Like, God says no. Like, we'll pray about it. We'll pray for you. But, like, there's no freedom to wrestle on a personal level. You can wrestle theologically, but not on a personal level.
And would you say that lack of freedom was really unhelpful, not having that space? I mean,
totally unhelpful. Like, there, like, the was isn't like the name, like, Jacob or Israel, something means to wrestle with God. And so it's like, that's, like, fundamentally built into, like, what it means to be in relationship with him. And they, like, that was just being quenched. And so, yeah, it was super unhelpful. Because I wasn't able to address those questions in my, like, faith community, it's like, I'm going to ask those questions anyway, so I'll just go somewhere else. It's like, I'm not getting answers from the people that I want to get answers from. So I began talking to some just, like, friends that I'd made in classes, at work, just opening up, like, hey, like, I kind of think I might be attracted to women. And the response that I got was the complete opposite. Yeah. Like, they were excited. They're like, yes, like, we get to be part of your coming out story. Like, we get to be part of this, like, new step in your life and you becoming authentically you. And I was like, wow, like, that is way more of the reaction that I was hoping for. Just even, like, the acceptance of, like, this is not something, like, shameful.
Right.
Like, I didn't want to be, I would never ask someone to change their theology just to make me feel better, but to engage me in dialogue about it is so freeing, and to not even have that with my faith community, like, just, like, piles shame onto it.
Yeah, you had almost two extreme communities here. One's just completely affirming, you know, no wrestling at all, just we can't wait till you come out. The other one, no freedom to genuinely wrestle. What do you think a healthy, maybe, I don't want to say middle ground, but kind of, you know, is there what would it look like for a Christian community who maybe does believe in a traditional sexual ethic, still provide healthy space for somebody to wrestle so that you're not just like, completely turned off of that community. You're just going to go find some other place to rest.
Yeah. I think, like, Christians often feel like theology needs to be weaponized to keep someone's behavior in place and, like, on the right track. And so, like, if people hadn't led with theology, I think it would have communicated something totally different. Wow. Like, because for me, even if I knew what most of their perspectives were, but, if they even just switched their response and said, wow, like, I know that's a hard thing to, like, process as a Christian. Like, are you okay? Mm-hmm. Like, that's asking if someone is okay isn't sacrificing any of your beliefs or values. It's caring for someone. Like, just think about the story of the Good Samaritan. Like, they crossed over the road to check on the person who was wounded. Like, you have to, like, overcome those, like, barriers and like the discomfort and like even the inconvenience of loving people, like overcome that to make people feel safe. And it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it's awkward and it's messy. And quite frankly, like, I mean, most of the time I don't want to do that. like, let me stay in my comfortable little box. But like, that doesn't, like, when people's hearts are on the line, it's worth it.
Yeah, totally. So you wrestled with your sexuality in college. When did that turn into a wrestling with your gender identity?
Yeah.
Was it shortly after? Or?
It was my senior year of college. So I came out to like Christian friends as like same sex attracted, because that's like the safe word to use. But I thought that like just coming out as that would be enough, like letting people know like this is my experience, and if you're gonna judge me, like maybe you're not someone I want in my life anyway. So I tried to ride that tension for a while. But my summer before my senior year of college, my mental health was declining a lot. Like I was really struggling with anxiety and depression. I had been on antidepressants for a little bit and they stopped working, and I cycled through like 3 or 4 different ones, and they still, like, I just kept responding poorly to all of them. And so I finally was like, I can't do this anymore. Like I can't live this in this tension, because it is taking a toll on my ability to like show up to life. I was calling into work multiple times a week. I was really struggling to even get out of bed, and just the any joy that I had in life was just quenched, because this feeling of like I just need to come out, and like it felt like I was being smothered by all how much I was thinking about and perseverating on my sexuality and my gender. And so the summer before my senior year of college, I came out as gay for about 3 months, and like that eased up a little bit of the tension, but it wasn't quite the right fit. Like something about it was like, this is nice, but like there's more to it than what I should be experiencing. Like this isn't quite right. And in a lot of just in like growing as a believer and processing through and just like maturing and processing through a lot of like issues from my childhood, I was working on going through a lot of my resentments, and I realized like I resented my parents a lot. I resented myself a lot, but I also resented God a lot. And a lot of my resentments that came up were about sexuality. But in taking that like moral inventory, I realized, oh, like there's a lot here about my gender too. Like I'm really mad at God that he made me a woman.
Wow.
And I don't know what to do with that. And that, but like realizing that made me have a little bit more, like, I feel a little bit more empowered of like, okay, at least I have a category for this now. But in those conversations about gender, again, like the church or my faith community was not a safe place for that. So as I opened up to like my other friends, their response was, you don't have to live with this inner tension that's causing you to feel so like anxious and depressed and on the verge of suicidal. Like you don't have, like you deserve better than that. And so I decided that my senior year of college, I was going to introduce myself by a new name. So I started going by Jamie. I started using male pronouns, and I really switched my wardrobe. Like before that summer, I had this last dramatic shift towards like trying to be feminine. Like I was trying to wear makeup and jewelry and dresses, and it was just...
How'd that go?
Not well. It just felt like really awkward. I was like, I'm looking at myself and I just constantly am so uncomfortable in my body, and like these clothes are just making it worse. So the shift after I came out in my classes, like I was thinking, I can introduce myself here. The semester is 4 months long. If this doesn't go how I'm assuming it will go, like I'm probably never going to see the people in my class again. So like it felt like a good trial period for it. Not that I made the decision lightly, but just knowing that I had an out, if I think made the weight of the decision a lot less.
Yeah. Did people accept you, I mean, in your environment as Jamie, or did you feel any kind of awkward responses or, you know?
It depended on the class. Like I was taking a lot of, it was my senior year, so I was in a lot of upper level psych and sociology classes. So when I'm taking classes like the sociology of gender, they're like, you, part of the protocol is introducing yourself and saying your preferred pronouns.
Okay.
So the classes that were more like progressive, for lack of a better word, created a space where I could experiment with that, or I could like come out. And even though like I still like, I wasn't changing that much permanently at that point, but it still was a space where that was respected.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then how long after did you begin transitioning? Yeah.
It took me, when I started changing my name, like the relief that I felt, like it wasn't like instantaneous, but it was really quick.
Okay.
Like it took maybe a month for me to start feeling like confident and comfortable and to notice like I'm actually like engaging people again. Like I'm laughing, I'm having fun, I'm being silly and playful. And like these parts of my personality are coming out that I thought were like dead, honestly.
You say that's just the name change.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's super helpful for someone who doesn't have the experience to understand, because oftentimes people who don't wrestle with gender dysphoria, who are perfectly fine with, you know, my male name and being a male, but like to understand somebody like in your case, so much like anxiety and just and depression and all this stuff leading up to it, and then finding that relief from the name. And then if a Christian comes along, or not just a Christian, but if somebody comes along and refuses to use that name, it's almost like another punch in the gut, right?
Yeah.
It's like you're taking away something that has brought me relief. Right or wrong, you know, whatever you think about the name thing, like that's the feeling I imagine.
Yeah.
It's like you're taking away something that has finally brought me some relief.
Yeah, and for me, it was just this white noise in the background. Like when I was going by Heather and female pronouns and trying to like look feminine, like there was this constant white noise of, this isn't right. I'm not doing this right. This feels wrong. Like how do I make myself feel okay about this? And it's just this narrative that plays in the background. And it was like, it's like someone turned off the power of the white noise, like it muted it when I finally started switching like my name and pronouns. Or even just turn the volume down a little bit, because it wasn't gone. But then the second like that gets questioned, or I have to like make a choice about what bathroom I was going to use, like the white noise went back up of like, am I going to be found out? Like, is someone going to tell me I'm in the wrong bathroom? Am I going to get called ma'am instead of sir? And it's just this constant like internal tornado that does not stop.
I've heard from, I think every single trans person I've talked to that go like the whole the turmoil that they go through when they have to go to the bathroom in public, just the, which one do I go in, what's going to happen, just the anxiety of having to use the bathroom in public is just constant.
Yeah. And there's the argument that it's like for like, even just the thought that it would be for like other people's safety is just so baffling to me, because it's like, I'm more worried about this, and I'm the one who's more at risk as like a like as a trans guy than anybody else in this bathroom.
Yeah.
And like, I just honestly just really just want to use the bathroom. Like it's not that deep, but we're making it like it's been made into this thing. Like wars are waged in the bathrooms.
Does it make you feel like a monster? I mean, it's like, wait, what, you think I'm going to harm somebody or something? Is that when they use that kind of rhetoric? I mean, is that,
I wouldn't say monster. It more of like, just made me feel really on edge. Like I like was on guard all the time. Like I had to make sure that like I would avoid eye contact with people, because maybe that would make them pay more attention to me. Or just, how can I fly under the radar as much as possible and just like go to the bathroom and then be done and like go on with my life. But like no one should have to think about it that much.
What about, so I would say the people, at least the more thoughtful people I know, when they raise concerns about the bathroom thing, it's not even really they're concerned as much, at least the ones I would talk to about a trans person using a bathroom that matches their gender. It's more somebody else, some straight cisgender pervert taking advantage of that, you know? And I guess, I'd love to hear your thoughts on
that. It just like grieves me that is a segue for like talking about like perverts or pedophilia or anything. Like those are two totally different conversations. Like someone who is going to like do anything harmful or in a bathroom is going to do that regardless of whether or not like trans people are allowed to use the bathroom that they want. Like that motive already exists. And if someone is motivated enough to act on that, like the gender or like the sign on a bathroom is not going to stop them.
That's good.
So.
Okay, so you socially transition, mm-hmm. and then you start after that. How long after when you started taking hormones?
It was, so I, classes started September. It was December that I finally got on hormones.
Okay.
In that time, I was like really hoping that God would like close doors if I wasn't supposed to be doing it. But it took 6 weeks to make a doctor's appointment when in reality it should have taken months. Mm. And so I started hormones that December, and I was on them for probably like 2 years total. Mm-hmm. But in the first few months, like my voice started dropping, like my body fat redistributed. Mm-hmm. So like my face got a little bit elongated and like, my like muscle mass shifted. So it just like kind of became more and more like appearing more and more like a cisgender guy to the point where I could pass, mm-hmm. which means to have people perceive me as the gender I want them to. So like I was trying to look masculine, or I was identifying as a transgender guy, and people were perceiving me as such. Yeah. And so I was passing, and that was really when I felt like things were like, I was like, this is good. Like this is just alleviating so much of that distress. Like, and I can I just saw so many of the initial like good changes continue to magnify as I began to look more and more masculine.
Okay.
So then I pursued changing my name legally, and I changed my gender marker legally. Like I did all the things that you like typically do to fully socially transition.
Okay. And was that satisfying? I mean, did it scratch the itch that you felt like needed to be scratched?
In the beginning, yeah. Like it ended up not sticking, because I'm here as Heather, but like in the beginning, yeah, I think like I was just, there was so much going on. Like I had this community that loved me and championed me. Like I found a place to belong. I found my identity, and there, like, I felt so much freedom from shame, because like in the LGBT community, there's no shame for being transgender. It's celebrated. So like the big things that like I was looking for answers on, like, am I loved? Am I accepted? Is the way that I'm made good? Like those core questions were being answered. With the momentum that I had, I was thinking like, this has all been so awesome. Like the last thing that I need to do to like alleviate this dysphoria that I'm feeling is to have top surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Cause so often for like trans guys, like that is the thing that like helps you like fix your dysphoria. That's not a good use of brain, but like helps you alleviate your dysphoria more mm-hmm. permanently. Like, because it's like the most permanent change on your body.
Most trans guys that I talk to say that their chest is kind of the thing that we would describe like the source of their dysphoria, yeah. almost, you know?
Yeah. Cause I was binding, up until I had surgery,
okay.
but there was always like this awkwardness with it, yeah. of like, is the shirt that I'm wearing showing that I'm binding? Like, are there telltale signs that I am transgender? And they're also just uncomfortable. Like yeah. there's just so many factors that like the binding versus like having top surgery, like the difference in the amount of dysphoria it alleviates is significant.
So after you've had top surgery, what was, tell us about the months after that. Again, did it help? Was it, you know, did it scratch that itch that you've been trying to scratch?
The leading up to it, I started to get a little nervous, but I just assumed that was because I was engaging in massive life change. Like I was gonna like
any surgery, right? Would just produce,
right? Yeah. Yeah. So like I was, my voice had dropped, and I could like, there are women who have voices mm-hmm. as low as mine. Like that's not totally out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
But surgery was permanent. Like
mm-hmm.
every like. There's no going back and having things be the same. And so I think just the gravity of it started to hit me. But after after surgery, when I like saw my chest for the first time, I just remembered having this like sinking feeling of like, oh, this is not what I was hoping it would be. Like this was supposed to be like soul level care and soul level satisfaction. And this is just on the surface. Like this is just trying to modify my body to deal with a soul level heartache.
Mm-hmm.
And so from there, like I saw my dysphoria shift to like non-gendered parts of my body. So like my arms, my legs, my stomach. And I realized that like it wasn't just like a hatred of my gender and a discomfort in my gender that I was processing through. It was a discomfort in who I was as a person. Like, it wasn't just like, I don't like being a woman. It was like, I don't like being me. I don't like who I am, and I don't like being who I am around other people, and I don't like being stuck alone with myself.
Yeah. So one thing as I've heard you share your story, one thing I really appreciate is you constantly emphasize that this is your story. You don't want to make your story prescriptive or even descriptive of all the other stories. I really appreciate that. So in your story, just to kind of reiterate, maybe draw out something you just said about you felt like you were you needed soul care, and you were addressing it with kind of physical or more surfacey things. Can you maybe elaborate on what was the kind of soul care you were really needing through all this?
As I began, after surgery, I saw my behavior beginning to spiral. So like I just saw myself like obsessively exercising and obsessively watching what I was eating, like trying to like obtain this perfect body. And so like when I look back and I'm like, what was my soul longing for? And I feel like just the rest of knowing that I was okay as I was, that there was delight in me for sheerly existing, not that that didn't have to be attained through any sort of like perfectionism or like trying to control things or, but like Heather is okay. Like Heather is good. Heather is wonderful. And no amount of trying to like destroy the identity of Heather and create a new one is going to shift the fact that like my soul, even though I was living as Jamie, I can't erase the past as Heather. And there's still this part of me that just really needed to know that like this part of my past, this person that I really didn't like she was okay. And like she, like there's just like this little girl Heather that like when I look back and think about it, there's this little girl Heather who just like is looking for love and like looking to be cared for and looking to be nurtured. And as an adult, like I was dealing with those feelings through transitioning, through obsessively exercising and drinking and all of these things. But at the end of the day, it was like this tired, lonely, really hurt little girl who just like needed love.
Wow. Yeah. So was it like two years later you decided, or no, it wasn't just you decided. Yeah. God was really truly leading you to re-identify as Heather. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, so it was actually pretty shortly after having top surgery. So I had top surgery February of 2017. And then it was that May that God started like interrupting things again. So after surgery and just the like full body dysphoria, not just gender dysphoria, like that prompted me to start looking back to like what God had, just like what God was saying. So because the answer that I had gotten from like my friends just from school or like my non-Christian friends, I guess, was that like transitioning would satisfy me and that would alleviate, like, cause it really is the only like solution for people struggling with gender dysphoria. Like the church doesn't really have a comparable option. And I tried that and it didn't work. And so I was like, I guess I'll go back to church. So I emailed some churches and I was very direct with them. I just said, I'm a trans guy. I want to be part of the children's ministry, worship team, and a life group. And like, if you're not okay with that, just please tell me now, because if I don't want to get 6 months down the road and have you realize that I'm trans and get kicked out. So there's this one church in Ann Arbor that was just awesome. Like they were really upfront with me about what they believed. They said like most people in our church believe that if you're born a female, like you should identify as a woman, but like, we're all just like in need of Jesus. And so welcome to our family. Like even if like we disagree, like you still have value, like you still have insight and gifts from the Holy Spirit that like we want to learn from. So like, come, like, let us learn from you. And like, hopefully you can learn from us too. And then at the same time I was looking, just like looking online, trying to find resources about like what it meant to be a man and woman. And I found this ministry that was describing like the core desires of a woman's heart. And one of them was to be delighted in. And that just hit my heart like so deeply, because it was like, oh my gosh, like, yes, that is what I'm looking for. And all of this, like, I just want to know that like I'm loved. Like it sounds so simple and yet like it's not. Like it is, it's so simple and yet it's so messy. And we live in a broken world, and I realized that, like, I identified so much with what they define a core desire of a woman's heart to be, like, maybe I need to start rethinking through, like, my gender. Okay. And I, in that time, like, I had plans, like, I'd gotten a scholarship to law school and I had planned to go attend, that fall. And I was starting to learn how to, like, hear God's voice again. And I felt like he said to turn down the scholarship. I was like, that's crazy, God. Like, this is like a full ride to law school. Like, that, I don't think you understand what you're doing. But I knew that I was hearing from God. And so I turned down the scholarship. And the next day, God asked me a few questions. Like, he asked me, like, why are you settling for your brokenness? And I mean, even just specifically relating to gender, I was like, that, I just thought, like, I have been operating out of a place of woundedness, like my femininity, viewing it as wounded. Like, I just shoved it to the corner. Like, yeah, I don't have to look at it or deal with it, but, like, it's also causing me to, like, just to engage the world out of this place of feeling like there's part of me that's defective. And this is all covering that up. Mm-hmm. And then he asked me, like, don't you know that I offer wholeness? And I was just honest with him. I was like, God, no, I don't. So, like, will you please prove it to me? And I think as Christians, like, it's really easy to feel shame when we say, like, God, no, I don't actually believe that you say the things that you believe. But the ability to be honest with him in that, like, for, like, just changed the trajectory of what my heart was willing to, like, receive.
God's not afraid of our doubts.
Right? Like, he, like, he's so confident in who he is, yeah, that, like, our doubts, like, I just, yeah, like, he just, I feel like if he, like, wants to give us, and he has given us such a big picture, but, like, when he's not, like, angry at us when we doubt, it's like, oh, like, yeah, oh, Heather, like, here you go again. Like, yeah, don't you know that I love you? Like, I do, so I'm going to show you again.
So good.
Yeah.
Wait, can you help us make sense of, like, in the last 10 years, there's been just such a massive increase, especially among teenage females, mm-hmm, either wrestling with their gender identity or, you know, identifying as male, or maybe another, you know, an alternative gender identity. I mean, and it's interesting because it's largely females. Like, mm-hmm, typically males would be slightly higher on, mm-hmm, the gender dysphoria scale, but then the last 10 years there's been like a hockey stick rise in females. Mm-hmm. Have you thought of that, or help us make sense of why that may be? Is there something in the culture with femininity that's confusing people? Or, I don't know.
I would have to think about it more, too. But my initial, like, I think part of it is there's always been more flexibility with femininity, mm, in some ways. Like, because of, like, toxic masculinity, like, men have to make a much more significant coming out story to, like, identify as trans or even as gay, because, yeah, like, there's so much more, like, it's has to be so much more intentional. Okay. Whereas, like, we, our culture has for a long time accepted that, of course, a woman wants to be more masculine. Like, we prize masculinity above femininity. And so, like, it makes sense to us that, like, and it's more accepting to us that, like, yeah, women want to, like, take a step up, whereas men coming out are taking a step down.
Because of the imbalance, the, yeah, hierarchy within gender. Oh, wow. That's,
yeah. So I think just, I feel like there's been more flexibility there anyway. My initial response is that, like, there's just more access to vocabulary to name it as gender dysphoria.
Okay.
Or to name, like, that pushback against stereotypes that, like, there's more ability to not be in secret about it. Mm-hmm. But I think our culture has always been one that's been set up with, like, of course women want to be like men.
Or even the idea, like, if you're a tomboy, yep, it's not that negative.
Yeah.
But to be a sissy boy or whatever, yep, whatever the male equivalent, that is, it's very negative, right?
Yeah.
So there is, like you said, there is more flexibility within, mm-hmm, gender expression with, mm-hmm, with females. A couple more questions. Sure. Like, I could talk to you forever, but, what would you say to maybe parents who have a child who, or teenager who's wrestling with, mm-hmm, their gender identity? Maybe they actually have, like, really severe dysphoria, or maybe they're just, and I don't mean this in a condescending way, but just more just confused, like, genuinely, yeah, confused about who they are. Mm-hmm. What help would you give to parents who are trying to parent their child through, yeah, that?
A lot of the parents that I've met with, I think, initially believe that it's something that they've done that's caused their child to experience dysphoria. Like, did we raise them too strictly? Were we not strict enough? Like, did we give bad images about masculinity and femininity? And so first and foremost, I just like hope that parents listening to this can just like ease that pressure off themselves. Like, there's so much that we don't know about what causes gender dysphoria. Like, is it nurture versus nature? Is it biological? Is it like having such strong stereotypes in the culture? It's probably a combination of all of the above. And so like easing off that pressure and then choosing to ask good questions without trying to fix your child's gender dysphoria. Like, when I was really starting to talk about it and feel it more, like, I was in my 20s at the time, so it's different than having younger kids, but I wish people didn't focus so much on the solution, but focus more on just understanding my experience. So, like, what is it, like, what is your gender dysphoria like? Like, what things bring it on more? What things help you kind of, what things help, like, make you feel more relaxed, like, help ease it, like, what does it, like, is it really loud or is it like a constant humdrum noise in the background? Just like trying to get a feel for what my experience was. Mm-hmm. Cause you can't walk with people through things until you have an understanding of what it's like.
That's so true. My gosh. Yeah. And what about, I guess more broadly to the church, how would you like to see the church improve in how it engages specifically the gender, transgender conversation? And also, number two, what would it look like for a church to cultivate, I'll say, healthy spaces for people to work through their gender identity?
Yeah, I think for churches, like, it has to start at the top. Like, so it's going to be different for every church, but, like, the leadership has to begin engaging this conversation as a team first and, like, understanding, like, are, like, choosing the act, like, it's an active choice to choose to defend, like, LGBT individuals in their church. Mm-hmm. Like, one thing that made me feel really safe in my church back in Ann Arbor was they were willing to lose, like, straight, have, like, heterosexual congruence over my, like, letting me be part of the church. Mm-hmm. Because they knew, like, they're going to have no trouble finding a new church, but, like, you as an LGBT individual, you are going to have a nightmare time finding a church that's going to love you.
Wow.
So they prioritized my spiritual well-being, knowing, not saying I'm more important, but knowing that, like, the resources for me are far fewer. And so, like, they prioritized that, but that was a choice from, like, that the leadership made of, like, we're going to make this a priority.
Okay.
And then that trickled into, like, just the heart posture of the congregation too. And even, I think too, like, even just knowing, like, how are we talking about gender in the really subtle ways too? Like, are, like, men's and women's times or, like, youth group events, like, are the men going and, like, eating wings and playing sports and, like, watching, I don't know, like, action movies? And are the women, like, drinking tea and crafting? Like, of course I want to be, like, playing sports, but somehow that misaligned with what the church was saying women need to be like. So it was very, boxed in my experience. Like, women do this, and this is how women connect with God. Men do this, and this is how men connect with God. But God looks at us as individuals. Like, no two women are the same. So I, like, would love churches to begin, like, having this heart posture of, like, okay, what does Heather need to connect with God? Like, what does Preston need to connect with God? Like, as a man or as a woman, but, like, as, like, masculinity in, like, your version of masculinity or femininity in my version. Because that might be, like, being outside, going in nature, playing sports. That could be crafting. Crafting's great, but, like, to have those blanket statements over an entire gender is really suffocating.
It's almost like you implicitly moralize a certain stereotype.
Yeah.
And even, let's just say 70%, let's just say 80% women would rather be crafting, I don't think that's true actually, but
yeah,
would rather be crafting than eating wings and playing, you know, dodgeball or something. Mm-hmm. What does that do to the other 20 or 30%?
Right.
Like, there's some, and it's not just like, oh, they feel like they're not part of the majority. They actually begin to question, right,
mm-hmm,
the very essence of who they are,
yeah,
as a woman. Like,
mm-hmm,
I am not honoring God and my womanhood because I don't like these things,
yeah,
that apparently define what it means to be a woman.
Yeah, and, like, even thinking about, like, whether it is only 1%, like, God still goes after, leaves the 99 to go after the 1. And, like, I want the church to, like, leave the 99 who love, like, these more stereotypical masculine and feminine things for the one person, like, one who, like, needs to know specifically that it's okay that you don't like these things. Your value is, and your femininity does not reside in, like, your preferences, in, like, the length of your hair, but it resides in the fact that, like, God calls you a daughter. And that's what matters. All of the preferences and stuff, like, God has given those to you to make you unique and to make you special, because, like, someone needs your unique giftings somewhere, sometime. Like, those are going to, like, be used for the kingdom.
Yeah, so good. Heather, thanks so much for being on my YouTube channel. Do you have any final words for our audience as they continue to think through this really important discussion?
I mean, I just would love to encourage everyone, like, don't be afraid to ask questions, like, to engage people in where they are. Like, the things that made me feel the most loved were people just asking, wanting to get to know my experience. Like, awesome. And that, like, you can never go wrong with that.
That's so good. So good. Well, thanks so much for being on, and we will see you next time on the show.